Loretta, good morning.
Good morning.
Last week it was published that Charladu will give an open talk about the Peter Hees book, and the topic is controversy. Why was he banned from the Savitri Bhavan to give lectures?
Well, that requires a very long answer, Miriam. It means I have to explain about all the controversy about Peter Hees's book and all the problems that have come from it. I am one person. There's nobody that has any real authority to judge ultimately what it is. But I can give the facts as I see it. And that means from the viewpoint of one person. So I come to this... it was a legal issue, and I was a lawyer. I was a constitutional lawyer, and this was a legal free speech issue, because they did file a lawsuit. And I have long association with the ashram, and also a great love of Mother and Sri Aurobindo and their teachings. So I come from this perspective. Peter Hees was an American scholar, and I've known Peter Hees for 40 years. I saw him and met him when I first came here because I'm an American and he's an American. And he's always a very concentrated person on his work, and he's written many articles, and he's always worked in the archives, and he's a very treasured person in the archives. And he undertook to write a book about the life of Sri Aurobindo. And the ashram trusted him, and he had carte blanche. He could do whatever he wanted with the archival research and all the collections in the archives. So he wrote a book. I couldn't go all the way through it. There was a point when I had to put the book down, and I'll tell you why. But I read the book, and the book is a marvel of detailed research. It's full of very interesting information about Sri Aurobindo and his life that other people haven't yet put in books. And it's incredibly detailed, and it goes into the history of his life and everything he did, everywhere he was, all the people that he was involved with, and his work with the revolution. But Peter Hees did something that nobody expected that he would do. He left out Indian culture and the Indian way of life. And actually, at some points, he criticized, or he, maybe the criticized is not the word, but he spoke as though he saw it from the standpoint of a Westerner who would not understand the Indian way of doing things, and so it comes out as a criticism. This includes the mystical part, the mystical part of Sri Aurobindo's work, the part that you couldn't see with your eyes and, so to say, touch with your hand and smell with your senses like that. And he just completely left that out. So when Sri Aurobindo's, most of his work was inner work. So when the book came out, the ashramites, who had all been waiting for it very eagerly because he was such a respected and honored person, Peter Hees was a respected and honored person, and Sri Aurobindo, of course, was so loved and honored and respected, and of course anyone who reads anything by Sri Aurobindo immediately is filled with respect and honor and veneration for this great being. So Peter Hees's book made Sri Aurobindo into a great being only on the things of the outer life, and he left out all those inner things. So when it came out, the ashram was, of course, very disappointed and hurt. And I can give you two examples, and they're small examples, but they were given to me by one of the women in the ashram. Sri Aurobindo married, and he chose his wife. And when people asked him about marrying, because at that point he was a great yogi, he said, well, I was a person and I wanted a wife. Very simple. And he loved his wife. So there's a photograph. There might be two, but I know there's one photograph of Sri Aurobindo taken with his wife. She's sitting in a chair, and he's sitting on the arm of the chair next to her. And they're not looking at each other. And she has a very expressionless face. And you look at his face and you can see all the openness and all the love that's in his eyes. But they're not looking at each other. And in Indian culture, until very, very recently, it was always joint families. And the couple never showed affection in front of the rest of their family. I mean, never. They didn't touch each other in public. Some families were so into this that the young couple didn't even speak to each other in front of the other members of the family. And we're talking around the turn of the century. So in his book, Peter Hees writes, well, we have this photograph. I can't quote it, but I can paraphrase it. We have this photograph of Sri Aurobindo and his wife, and he's not even looking at her. He clearly didn't want to have anything to do with her. Now, for us, that may not mean much, but for the Indian people and the people in the ashram, that was really a terrible thing to say. It was simply wrong. He made allusions to the fact that another reason we can tell that Sri Aurobindo wasn't interested in his wife is she didn't live with him very much. And when you look at all of the ways of India down through, let's say, the last century, you find that people often lived apart for many years. It was normal. It was common. And the woman went into the joint family, and she was part of the family. And the relationship endured, and it was fine. And it's not because Sri Aurobindo didn't want to have anything to do with his wife. It's because he had other things that he had to do, and she understood that. So this is a very small example. And I only say these things because I didn't go into a study of it, and I didn't want to sit and hear people's grief about it, you know, so I didn't listen to these things. But the book is full of these tiny inaccuracies and strange criticisms based on the consciousness of someone who doesn't know what he's talking about, which is a little odd because...
He was around, as you said, he came 40 years ago, so he's supposed to knew everything. So what happened that he wrote a book like that? Because I believe in 40 years you also get accustomed to the Indian traditions and culture and ways to do things.
Well, there are two possibilities. I mean, we don't know for sure, but either he really never found out anything about it, either he lived completely in his own small world and he didn't want to know about it. That's a possibility. The other thing is that, and again, this is from my point of view, because I know my own culture. He was from the eastern part of America. And there's a kind of, I would call it, and again, it's just me, I would call it a New York attitude. It's a kind of coming around the back door to finally compliment someone. It's a kind of snide way of insulting someone but making it a compliment. And when you read Peter Hees's book, you find there's a feeling of holding back, and he gives all these facts. And finally he says, well, yeah, and it really was a miracle. And I don't know if that makes sense to you.
Yeah, but it's strange still. Because I think the 40 years, must have left some impact on him. Somehow.
Yeah, no, I agree. It brings us to the possible conclusion that he wrote for an audience, and he put what he called the truth in what the audience would read. That's possible, because there's a whole, as you and I have often talked in our talks, that there are people who can't hear the things that people on the path of Sri Aurobindo's yoga have realized. And he may have thought that he could sell more books by not bringing out or extolling these other aspects of Sri Aurobindo's life, which is not accurate from the standpoint of the fact that Sri Aurobindo, you could say, was like an iceberg. The part that you could see and touch was one-tenth above the surface, and this tremendous being with all his powers and capacities was the other nine-tenths of the iceberg. And I'm using the analogy of an iceberg as something when you see it, you see only the top 10%, okay. And then the other 90%, you don't see it. So Sri Aurobindo, it wasn't in that sense like an iceberg, because 90% of him, you can't objectively experience it with your senses. It's your feelings and, you know, your inner response to Savitri and his poetry and the greatness of his being. So there's a concept, there's a word, it's called hagiography. And what that means, I'm not sure of the dictionary definition, but I think it means a kind of blind worship and, you know, kind of going nuts with love and devotion and saying all these wonderful things about this person over devotion. And I do know that one of the points of this book was not to write like that. I believe there are places where it's been published that the point of this book was that there wasn't any hagiography in it.
Okay, so book was published and ashramites were not happy?
Well, no. Of course the ashramites were not happy.
Okay, less than that.
I mean, but you have to also understand the Indian culture. There's something called bhakta, and bhakta means devotion. And so there's a point where there's a line, and over that line, you are a bhakta. That means that much more of you is involved in devotion than in, say, wisdom or something. I mean, in all the yogas, there are all these different kind of yogas, according to Patanjali. There's Jnana Yoga, which is the yoga of wisdom. There's Hatha Yoga, which is the yoga, the physical of the body, which most people in the West think of as the only yoga, because that's what came out first. And there's Bhakta Yoga. And Bhakta Yoga is when it's just love. But the Indian people are by nature open, and their souls are open. And since the universe is made by love and is made of love and their souls are open, they love. And they love everything and everybody. If you look at their culture, you will find that they are devoted, and they express devotion like some people express devotion to movie stars. They express devotion to everything. They want to love and they want to worship. Their whole family life and structure is set up in worship of their parents. In the old days, the Indian children came and touched their parents' feet in devotion. And you still, I mean, people still, if someone has done something wonderful or they really feel open, they will want to touch your feet, even Westerners. So this is their nature, and this is the life that they know, and this is the way they embrace the world. And Peter Hees brought out a book that not only is totally devoid of any feeling or admiration or praise for Sri Aurobindo, but comes about it through the back door in a kind of sour way. And again, this is the way I see it, but this is, you know, it's like a streetwise, snide person who's not had a great deal of love and grace and beauty in their life, approaching life with a tremendous cynicism. Mm. So anyway, this is how I see the book.
And Peter Hayes was, all these 40 years, was only Ashramite, or he joined the Oroville at some point?
No, he was never in Oroville. He was only an Ashramite, and he was only in the archives. Mm. He had nothing to do with Oroville on any level. And we don't know what he did in the ashram, except that he was in the archives. Mm. So, I mean, I've gone through all this stuff, because you have to understand how this can inflame anybody. To us in the West, we might think, well, okay, the guy made a few mistakes. You know, it's a great book. It's full of facts. But it's like if someone was writing about your child, let's say, or your father, and completely misrepresented the truth of what they were and only talked about the outer things they did and not the kind of person they were, and made mistakes in the facts. So now we have to look at what the problem was, because the Ashramites, at least the ones that I spoke with, were just full of grief and sorrow, and they were worried, you know, that this book would go out and Sri Aurobindo would be so badly represented in the world. But they didn't do anything about it. They're all, you know, they because they wouldn't. What could they possibly do? But there were some people in the ashram who did decide to do something about it. And it broiled up into a tremendous fight, to the point that the ashram was split. And there was a lot of negativity. And probably the question that one could ask is, this is the Sri Aurobindo ashram. These are people who have been doing the yoga. They're following Sri Aurobindo and the mother. How could this happen?
It does happen. Still, we all got residues of things from the past and the ego levels and stuff.
Well, do you know the Bhagavad Gita?
Yeah.
You know that central story where they're about to fight the battle of Kurukshetra, and the Kauravas are all lined up on one side. You can kind of see it in your mind when you read it. And the Pandavas are all lined up on the other side. And Arjuna was a Pandava. He was one of those brothers. And his charioteer is Lord Krishna. And, of course, this is all symbolic, and because Lord Krishna was this great consciousness, and he's driving Arjuna's chariot. And Krishna, battle is about to begin, and Krishna pulls up the chariot right in the middle, and on one side is the Kauravas, and one side is the Pandavas, and Arjuna looks on one side, and he sees his brothers and their families. On the other side, he sees his guru and his teacher and all these, and all people that he loves. And he doesn't want them to die, and he doesn't want to see it. And so he sits down on the step of the chariot, and he puts his hands on his knees, and he says, I'm not doing this. I'm not going to fight. And Lord Krishna says to him, well, you have to fight, because this battle has already been fought. And what Krishna means is that the individual natures of these people have brought them to the point where their natures are going to express themselves as they must in the press of their karma, and they have to end the way they're going to end. And of course, the whole Mahabharata is these little stories, a lot of them symbolic, but giving the failings in these people and the solutions and all of these things. So this is what we have. This Kurukshetra, if you want to call it that, has to be fought, because what's inside these people is ready to come out, and it's coming out now. So it's a kind of a purification. And the people who've taken sides are people who have something in them that this speaks to. You know, I would, most of the people that I personally am acquainted with, that I've known for 40 years, all these very old ashramites, they're not having anything to do with it, because there's nothing inside them. I mean, there's nothing inside them
to do it.
To that is open, that is open for these forces to come inside them and express themselves. I mean, Sri Aurobindo and the mother were so conscious in all the planes of being, and they taught us what they knew. And so we know that the vital forces, our emotions and our feelings, come from vital planes, and they are vital beings, you know. And we know that these, what they call asuric forces, are living beings. And we also know from their writings that their time is quickly coming over because of the new consciousness coming into the creation. Mother says that an asuric being is a conscious being, and he knows that his plan for life is against the truth. And so these things are acting very strongly. There's this wonderful quote of the mother where she says, before dying, falsehood arises in full swing. And so this is what's going on. There's this maelstrom, this holocaust. And so you've got these guys, and some of them who came to the ashram as smaller children and who grew up in the ashram, acting out what they think is right. So they're against Peter Hees. Mm-hmm. They don't want the ashram to recommend his visa. They want to kick him out of the country. They filed a lawsuit. And this lawsuit...
The lawsuit against who?
They filed a lawsuit. I haven't read what they call the moving papers. Hmm. So I believe they filed the lawsuit against the ashram. And they, in order to file a lawsuit, you have to show that people have broken certain laws. Now, I have to say that as a constitutional lawyer in the United States, and having done a little bit with free speech, not a great deal, such a lawsuit would have been thrown out of court with the first opposition papers from the other side, because it's a free speech right. And the First Amendment in the United States gives the right to free speech. And
but it's valid in India?
India has free speech laws. I don't know exactly what they are, but they do have a law against publishing something that incites to religious riot. Inciting to religious riot. Now, I don't know how many other places were incited to religious riot, but these people who filed the lawsuit seem to act like they were incited to religious riot. And they filed injunctions asking the High Court they filed requests for an injunction. An injunction is something that is the lawsuit's going on. But on the way, you can ask for quick relief. At the end of the lawsuit, you can ask for final relief, but you can ask for a quick relief. And the quick relief was that the ashram should refuse to sign the guarantee for Peter Hees's visa. Mm-hmm. Well, the ashram did not refuse to sign the guarantee, but I don't know to this date if he's received a visa, but he is still here.
He's still here because one of the letters I saw that somebody was saying, if Peter Hees is also invited to the talk, it's supposed to be in Sautru, Ishradalo, and she said maybe it would be better to postpone it because he's temporarily out of station.
Okay, he comes and goes. Mm. I mean, it's not like he's out and he never came back.
Well, he's just in India, but somewhere.
I don't know if he's in India, but I do know that he was in America for some time and that he did come back, and maybe he's gone again. That I don't know. Mm-hmm. And the High Court ruled that, and with the law, they gave the law that it was not their place.
Religious, no.
It was not their place. No, this issue of the inciting to religious riot, and I believe there were some other things all in this form, has not been resolved. But one of the things that they seem to have been very strong about was that the present regime in the ashram did such a bad job with Peter Hees that they should be kicked out. So the people who are now running the ashram should be removed. And this has caused a tremendous amount of grief and a lot of reaction. And it's hurt a lot of people. And the ashram is full of sadness. I can feel it. You know, the ashram is running as usual. You can tell the people who are doing their sadhana are doing their sadhana.
But I notice they're more edgy.
People are more edgy, and there's sadness. There's these lines from Savitri: "The bliss that has made the world has fallen asleep." You know, there's sadness, but the ashram is moving on. The trustee of the managing trustee of the ashram has gone through this like a prince. I mean, he's had to do so much and so many difficult things, and he stood there like a rock. It's really wonderful. The ashram did publish something which basically said everyone has the ability and the right to reject this book for themselves if they want to. And so there it stands. Now, you originally asked me why was Shraddhalu banned?
In February he was banned from to give any more lectures or talks at Savitri Bhavan, yeah? By the working committee?
He was, and I actually can tell you a little bit about that because my exhibition was in Savitri Bhavan at that time. Mm-hmm. I'm going to go back to give a little history. The American people, some of them, not all of them, reacted very strongly to this idea of banning Peter Hees. They felt that this was not right. And there was a kind of rallying of support, not only in the ashram. In the ashram, it was sort of either for the trustees who gave permission for the book to be published, or against the trustees because they shouldn't have given permission. But here it was for the people who are trying to support Peter Hees, or against the people who are trying to support Peter Hees. So there was a lot of people here in Oroville got involved in the fact that the people in the ashram who were trying to kick Peter Hees out, those rebels who filed a lawsuit, they shouldn't do that. So I hope I've made myself clear. Mm-hmm. It's a little confusing, but basically the Westerners and the Orovillians rebelled against the fact that an American should be denied India because of freedom of speech. I mean, you have to understand that we as America are soaked in these constitutional principles. We're filled with something called democracy. And I will say, when I first came to India in 1969, and India had gotten its independence in 1947, I, as an American, was told very proudly by the people, "We are a democracy." And I watched them function, and I could see they didn't know what a democracy was. You can't get it by reading it in a book. I was born in it. I was born in it. And so you have that here. So this is what's operating. So now the working committee has turned against the people who have turned against Peter Hees. And Shraddhavan is an extremely democratic person. She has run Savitri Bhavan, she accepts. And she's always done that. And they got this notice, and they started having these meetings. And I was there and I was seeing they were in meetings and meetings and meetings, and I asked someone what it was about. And they said, well, they've been told that they have to take Shredaloo out, and they're having meetings about that. So they had the final meeting, and it was very tense. The atmosphere was very tense. And then they all came out of the meeting, and I saw their faces, and there was this tremendous relief and release and kind of balance. And I asked Radhavan what it was, and she said, wait a little bit, because we're publishing a written statement. And I understood why she said that. She didn't want to say something that I would misunderstand. She wanted me to hear what everyone had decided upon. And then afterwards, she gave it to me to read. And the written statement said that they have considered everything and they've thought about it, and Savitri Bhavan is there for everyone to give everything that they have from their heart. But they have been put in the position to choose between the ashram trustees and the people who are against the ashram trustees, and that they cannot not support the ashram. They cannot. And so very reluctantly, they're making a hiatus, a break in Shredaloo's talks. So that's what happened. These people, these very powerful warriors, these Kurukshetra battlers that have to fight their battle, it was the end of December. I was in the ashram and I was talking to the mother of Shredaloo. She's been an old friend of mine. I mean, known her since I came, you know. And she was telling me that they were going to stage a sit-down demonstration. I mean, this just makes you think of Sri Aurobindo fighting against the British. They're doing these things. So it was going to be on New Year's Day. And on the 29th of December, there was the cyclone that just raged through everything. And I thought, well, boy, I guess they haven't done their demonstration. And several weeks later, I mentioned it to someone. They were trying to talk about all this, and I try not to talk about it. And I said, I guess, you know, with the cyclone and all that, they must have figured out that things were too agitated already. And they said, oh, no, they had their demonstration.
They did?
They did. And then they did another one. So, I mean, you can see the power of this movement, you know, and where it's going.
But there were some rumors that actually Shredaloo wanted to take over and to be in charge of the ashram.
Well, they want somebody to take over. That's clear.
But he got that ambition?
I don't know. I don't talk with Shredaloo much, and I don't really want to be involved. So no one's ever told me that that's true, and I've never read it. But it's very clear they want somebody else at least to take over the ashram. And I mean, I have to go often to the trustee because I have to get permission to get things from the ashram for all the work I'm doing. And I put up a poster of my stuff in the ashram courtyard. And I see what this man has to do. I mean, he has to make sure the school is functioning. He sits at his desk. I go and see him in the morning. He comes at 9:30 and he sits at his desk. And this line of people forms. And they come and they complain about this, and they complain about that, and this is a problem, and that's a problem. And then people come, devotees come, they want a card to go to Sri Aurobindo's room, and you know, families come just to bring their children, and I mean, it's a terrible job. You have to have such strength and such fortitude and such understanding, and you know, and his whole life is this. You know, I mean, I don't know why anybody would want this job. And I'm speaking because I wouldn't want this job. Mm. But anyway, So I don't know if Schrodelo himself or any members of the people that are supporting him in doing this want to sit in that chair. I can't say.
Practically has not much to do with Orwell. So why is Schrodelo decided that he want to bring the talk on the book at Saucho?
Because that's part of the battle that he's fighting. He wants to gain his objective. He wants to be heard. He wants to do anything he can to get what he wants.
He's an excellent speaker.
That's normal. A lot of people really like to go and hear him speak. He has a very mellifluous voice. He has a very musical voice. And he's a very imposing-looking figure. I can't say. I read his book as far as I was able to read it. And I didn't think much about the omissions and things about Sri Aurobindo. I could see his style. You know, I understood this kind of backwards kick in the pants compliment. And again, this is the way I'm seeing it. It has to be really clear. But then I got to the point where he started talking about mother. And he talked about how mother came to Sri Aurobindo. And he said that mother left, and during the time mother was here, Sri Aurobindo hadn't even looked at her. He never actually looked at Mira Alfasa or Mira Richard. And it shows that he wasn't interested in who the mother was at that time. And that really struck me, because everything that the mother has said about her relationship with Sri Aurobindo was really different. And Peter, he's had to have read those things, because he was a scholar, you know. I mean, mother talked about at the age of between 11 and 13 receiving teaching at night. And one teacher came more than the other teachers, and she knew she was going to work with this man. And she didn't know about Indian philosophy, but she called him Krishna. And it was Sri Aurobindo, and she recognized him when she saw him. Sri Aurobindo said about the mother, he said, "I entered the supermind through the back door. Mother entered the supermind through the front door." I mean, what a thing to say. You know, of course he was involved with her. And then mother says this wonderful thing. She says that at one point they were standing together on a terrace, side by side. She said, it wasn't like my head was resting on his shoulder. She said, but that's how we were together. And we were seeing that this future would materialize. I mean, when mother was there, she did, she organized all his writings. She kept all the books. How could he not look at her? It's just, you know, it's just not real. And that's the point that I put the book down. And I stopped reading, and I returned it to the person who had loaned it to me. I mean, I think that people need to just love Mother and Sri Aurobindo. And whatever's wrong with this whole situation will simply go away. Mother said, in peace and harmony, the eternal manifests. And she said, the first thing that you have to base everything on is harmony. When you have disharmony, things don't work. That's the first rule. And I think that that's what we need to feel. If we feel real harmony inside ourselves, all that stuff won't come inside us anyway. We won't be able to take sides. If we really concentrate on our own development and we don't look at other people and what they do, the thing will disintegrate. Whatever's real will stay, whatever is the truth will stay. But if you don't give it any energy, then the wrong energies have to go away. If no one had made a fuss, if no one had been open to these forces, that Peter Hee's book wouldn't have gone anywhere. It would have been another book, and it would have been another book.
Yeah, true. I mean, the publicity, actually, he got the publicity now with that. What is the title of the book, anyhow?
I'm really sorry, but I can't remember. I haven't looked at it. It's been actually years. And I've really just kept the whole thing as far away
But when it was published?
Possible. I believe it's been at least 2 years since this controversy has gone on. Hmm. I mean, you can find all that stuff out and put it in the read further, all of these facts. I don't have the book at home, so I can't give you the book. I mean, it was going to be advertised as this book, the definitive work, you know, the work on the life of Sri Aurobindo.
Thank you.
You're welcome.